Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
And happy Thursday, everybody. Welcome to the show, Point Taken. It is Steve and Kristen on this Thursday. I'll just say this. I'm disappointed because I said yesterday I thought they'd have the votes. They didn't have the votes. The state has rejected. This legislature, I should say, has rejected what I would say is a compromise deal. I think the vote was 15-18.
I have the. You want to hear the sound?
Sure.
There are 15 ayes and 18 noes. The bill is not concurred in.
So it died in the Senate. All of the Democrats plus three Republicans voted no on the bill. And it was a day. A lot of quotes. A lot of good quotes from the floor yesterday.
A lot of people talking before the vote. Not that many afterwards.
Yeah,
they're all quiet. Except for Missy Hughes.
Missy Hughes had a statement.
Yeah, I'm
going
to read that statement.
And I do think, I mean, there's so many different angles and ways to talk about what happened. There is the politics of it. There is the actual dollars and cents of it. There is the structural change versus, you know, one day, pay me today. We'll deal with the rest of it tomorrow and kick the can down the road. Who is doing this for political gains? Who is doing this because they're going to be there for the next budget and actually worried about what structural deficits we have? So where would you like to start? I'll say this, because I know where you stand. I feel like the Gemini in me is really coming out because I can see a lot of different sides of this. So I'm going to maybe do some jujitsu on the different things that you have to argue.
You have the floor.
My biggest thing, and maybe this is a difference of an ideal statement. But my thing is, so Evers fought as hard as he has to get the maps that we have now. And the maps that we have now mean that there is more, not a supermajority of Republicans in the legislature. And this scenario worked out not unlike what the budget was last summer, where he ended up needing Democratic votes in the Senate and yet involved zero Democrats in the negotiation. And from what it seems like, no one even knew about the bill before Monday, and then were forced to take a vote on it by Wednesday. And I'm not sure that politically for him, if he really wanted this bill done, I do think there's some blame on him, for he and his staff could have handled this differently as far as how they rolled it out and getting buy-in from other leaders in the party.
I don't disagree. Yeah, you should always try to involve this idea that you're going to involve everyone is
and I'm
silly.
I'm not saying everyone, but
leadership.
There was leadership.
The Hasselbeins of the world.
Yes.
So yeah, I don't
people
disagree
who sit on joint finance.
Yeah, I don't disagree.
And so there's that aspect of it. I do think that there is, you know, you've put Tom Tiffany in there, and apparently he played a role as far as siphoning off some of the Republican votes
the three negative votes, I would say, probably.
And trying to get them to vote no because this helps him campaign on something. We obviously know, I mean, this is also a point for all of the candidates who are running for governor to differentiate themselves as far as, like, the worst thing you could do right now as a candidate is have some kind of middling take on what happened yesterday. You're either like, this was a bad deal, and put your whole chest behind it of saying why it was a bad deal, which is, I think, is where you see Fran Hong and Kelda Royce. And then you have someone like Missy Hughes, who had a pretty scathing
message
this morning as far as where she feels like this is just bad politics and egos getting in the way instead of people really leaning in and working together. Yeah, read some of it.
I'll give you this is the heads up. This is my Say Something Nice on Friday.
Ooh.
Tomorrow. Yeah. Pretty easy. Direct quote, Missy Hughes, candidate for Democrats for governor. Last night, Tom Tiffany killed a common sense plan to invest more badly needed resources in our schools and to provide property tax relief to Wisconsin families struggling with high costs. Absolutely right. Shockingly, Tiffany was aided and abetted by certain self-serving Democratic candidates. If I could, like, jump and, like, high-five Missy Hughes, I would do it right now. That's candidate for Governor Missy Hughes. And what did I say to you in a cleansed format after you sent me that? She effing nailed it. That's exactly right. This is a victory for trolls, people who are politics influencers and the Twitter, you know, experts, keyboard warriors. They're all happy today because they've taken their side. They feel like they have a victory, but you end up with nothing. The people who lost in this are the taxpayers. And I was going to do this, and I'll try to do it quickly. So I was talking to some school board members last night.
Okay.
Because I'm actively working on a panel of people to come on the show and talk about education from that perspective. We don't, frankly, hear it enough.
And well, we hear about school boards a lot. We don't necessarily talk to school board members.
No.
Often. That's true.
So I'm having this conversation. I'm not going to say which member that I was talking about. But the numbers they would have received are in the millions of dollars for things like special needs, operations. Because if you believe anybody who knows education in the state of Wisconsin, there is a looming fiscal cliff that's built into the cake, that's baked into the cake, that we're going to have to face. So this was a way, yes, one time. Many of these things, rebates are always one time. You don't pass a rebate that you get every year. So that's...
But that's another part of this that I think was lost in the high level talking points. Oh, $300, $600. It wasn't actually that. It was based on how much you paid in.
Right.
So the people who, you know, make over six figures were going to get the $300, $600.
You mean the people that paid the taxes?
No, I know. But I'm just saying, as far as does that move the needle as far as who's hurting the most right now?
I understand the point. But to give, I think, as much as we like to say we don't do things for poor people, we're a pretty generous state. We have programs. We have incredible charitable organizations. We do a lot in this state. We're probably better than most, actually, in our generosity. So I don't necessarily buy into the we could do more. Yes, we can always do more. We can always be better to our fellow man. Absolutely sign me up. I'm part of that camp. But this idea that we don't do anything or we should give people rebates that don't actually pay taxes into the system, I have a problem with that.
I don't think it's about giving rebates back to people who didn't pay into the system. I think it's a bigger question of, in a time where a lot of people are tightening their budgets and there's a lot of looking down the road of like, we've spent decades underfunding schools. There's a big problem with how we fund schools.
$18,000 per student in the state of Wisconsin.
I understand that, but it's all as far as like, it's all the things we talk about with Cleston, and I know we talk about with Quentin Claybon sometimes, as far as like, we have a baby bust looming, as far as the under-babied, if we want to bring that term back from earlier this week.
Not really.
But as far as how we're thinking about school districts, how we're thinking about teacher allocation, like there's a lot of bigger long-term problems instead of just fixing something or like alleviating something today. And also, not to mention, we don't know with the Trump budget, like all the budget cuts that are coming from Medicaid and hospital assessment and some of the other things that are coming down the line, what money we're going to need. I'm playing devil's advocate. Like I said, I see both sides, but I just
think that forgetting that some of the things baked into this bill were aid for schools, special needs students. You mentioned the direct payments, helping on property. If you own a home or a property, property tax relief, that helps everybody that owns property. So, I mean, there are things that were in here that are actually pretty good ideas. There's a lot to say. We've got to take a break. We're already running late.
Let us know what you think.
Yes.
855-616-1620. We'll get to some of your texts. We'll get to some of the fun audio from yesterday as well. This is Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen. He's Steve. We are talking about the big showdown yesterday during the special session where the Assembly did pass the property tax relief bill, but it died in the Senate. If they rework the bill, is there a chance that Governor Evers could call another special session before the election?
Yeah, is that right?
Or do you think it's just dead in the water because this is a sign that there's people in the legislature who don't want this deal to be done?
Yeah, full disclosure, I don't know.
Yeah.
And you'd have to get those three senators, Hutton, Kapenga, Nass, to change their mind. Before we, I know you have some great audio, and I actually love is it Bob Donovan? That one's just, that's a classic one. I'm not generally a fan of some of the things he says, but that's awesome.
Should we play that one?
Just so people are clear, I want to make people, I want to be a listener as well as a talker, and I am fundamentally disappointed in this decision by the legislature. If there's any confusion on that, I think it's lazy. I think it's unintellectual. I think it's sort of a nod to the election that's coming rather than just doing your damn job now. There's all of those things. I find it interesting that all these vocal Democratic candidates, other than Missy Hughes, are completely silent today. They're crafting their well-written press releases, I'm sure. I'm sure they're all busy.
You
on
check
that.
Everyone's Twitter?
Not only that, I checked the Twitter and I had ChatGPT check
Fran
the Twitter.
Fran Holmes said something this morning.
I hope she did. I hope it's well thought out. And my advice to those kinds of candidates, life ain't Twitter. Life ain't social media. You can have a hell of a campaign on social media and get your you-know-what kicked in the primary. You might want to think about that. Real people, real, some solutions, not perfect. Perfect, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. So I'm fundamentally disappointed, as are a lot of people, in this decision. All right, audio.
All right, so if you could wish for anything, what would you wish for, Steve?
I want to win the lottery.
What about what Donovan wants? His biggest wish in life?
I don't. Some of my colleagues on the other side, a lot of wishful thinking. Oh, I wish that the bill included this, or I wish the bill included that. We all wish a lot of things. Hell, Mr. Speaker, I wish rainwater was beer.
I like beer, but not that much. That's a lot of beer, especially in those monsoon rains we've had this year. So I love the humor of it. He's not wrong. Let me read a quote to you. Or do you have more audio?
I have a ton of audio, but Rita, go ahead and read your quote.
This is from the governor of
It's powerful.
He's the most powerful, should be the most powerful elected Democrat in the state. I mean, that's
not the shadow governor, Robin Voss.
Yeah. Anybody, you know, I know that the popular meme and talking point is that he's a lame duck. Shut the hell up, internet trolls. Governor Tony Evers, so many with threat quotes, so many Wisconsinites feel left behind, frustrated, and disillusioned by politics these days. My words, you think? Because they think a lot of politicians in the Capitol are only here to serve themselves. Pause. And today, they're right. Like, the opportunities for say something nice are just dropping in our laps for Friday, at least for me and Bill. Easy stuff.
All right, so friend of the show, Deb Andraka,
yes,
voted no against
this. And
I
like Deb.
And she had a fun play with words.
Proposal is a turducken. Because it's a turkey that was put together by a bunch of lame ducks, by a Republican legislature that is too chicken to confront the structural affordability and education issues facing this state.
Turducken.
Clever wordplay. Yeah, I like that. Once you go to lame duck argument, I have no use for you. They're elected to serve. They haven't stopped serving. He's still got some time in office, by the way. He ain't done for a while, Governor Tony Evers.
He still has the rest of the year.
Because you deem, and I like Deb, she's a great guest on the program, if you deem someone lame duck, then anything they do, then you just throw it away? Is that the argument? Is that the Dan Schaefer argument
on
this?
So is there no argument then as far as three guys who are not going to be there next year, and not to say that they don't still have both their party and their constituents' thoughts and feelings in mind as they were crafting this. But as far as people who are going to be there in the next session and do have to deal with whatever the financial landscape is come next year, that some buy-in, some thought from them would have been useful in this negotiation?
I would argue that that's their work product when they get elected next time, and they can work on that. This is a Band-Aid bill. This was a direct relief to taxpayers through property tax relief, rebates. You can pretend it's something more. And again, going on what I perceive about the Wisconsin State Legislature, who in their right frickin' mind thinks these folks are going to come up with a better solution then? Are you serious?
I mean, this is putting...
you think Fran Hong is going to figure this out?
This is potentially putting the cart before the horse for Democrats. Like, if they are this... and this is thinking that they are going to that confident that they're going to get the trifecta. This is potentially harkens back to 2010, the last time Democrats had a trifecta, and they didn't pass a bunch of things because they thought they were going to keep majorities going into the next year. And then you served up 16 years of Republican control, at least in the legislature, and 8 years of a Republican trifecta.
Go ahead.
Don't count your chickens before they're home to roost. Is that how that goes?
Come home to roost.
Come home to roost, yeah.
Good job. That's an old one. Yeah. You're learning.
Rigmarole.
Yeah. I don't know if you spelled it right, though. Did you spell it right? Somebody asked if you spelled the rigmarole right. I have to look it up. Look, here's my warning for Democratic candidates and Tom Tiffany, who's going to be joining us in a couple weeks, I think. I'm generally perceived as a pretty nice, calm interviewer. I'm not going to be so nice because I'm pissed off about this.
Oh, and Tom Tiffany's here in the
Not just Tom Tiffany. Anybody else that comes from the other side that you coming on our show, be prepared to answer the questions. Because you basically played the politics game. And if you know anything about me, and by the way, when you come on the show with either of us, do some homework. Because somebody asked me a question the other day about me. That you want to come on the show and you don't know my history, my bio, what I do, what I...
Ooh, who was this?
I'm not going to say.
You tell me a commercial?
Don't come to me with that nonsense. Do your homework. So, yeah, I am pissed. Quick break. Real quick before I get to break here, from Fran Hong, some people's idea of the leading candidate for the Democratic nomination for governor. Wisconsin lawmakers saw through the con of election year gimmicks with long-term threats to our stability. We will fix the real structural issues our schools and communities face. I would ask her what we means. But that takes smart and intentional investment, not backroom deals. Again, from the most powerful Democrat in the state, your leader, your fearless leader, and high-pressure tactics. High pressure. Was there high pressure in this? They weren't even asked.
Well, it was a fast timeline to see the bill Monday and vote by Wednesday.
That's the characteristic of special sessions.
That's fast timeline. Yeah. Someone asked a clarifying question. Just for clarification, are you both saying the bill should have passed?
Yes.
You were unequivocally saying yes.
Yes.
I am saying I can see some of the arguments of why people voted no and that this could have been handled differently. So I am not running for governor, so I do have a middling answer.
Wow. I'm not going to say that's nuanced. That's sort of...
I do. I think I see some of the arguments as far as people saying why this wasn't a great bill.
All right.
Well, as we move on from talking about the failed bill yesterday, I'm sure we're going to talk about it more with Bill and Joe tomorrow.
Oh, yeah. That's right. That should be our lead story.
But part of that, obviously, is what we were talking about with education funding and special education reimbursement. But there was some studies reporting that came out yesterday, both bad news, not only just for Wisconsin, but across the country. And it makes me a little nervous as far as I don't know what my options are as my kid eventually starts going to school and what the heck is going on with our schools. So the top line for Wisconsin is that there was out of 38 states, because there was a handful of states that didn't have enough data to be included in this study, but that Wisconsin ranks 33rd out of 38 in math and 30th in reading recovery among, like I said, 38 states. Not great.
Anecdotally, off the top of your head, give me one or two reasons why you think this is happening. Since it's been going on since 2013, 2015, that time period.
I mean, it's not totally anecdotally
because
I already read the stories. Because on the national level.
I mean, a feeling.
So what I don't know is, I think it is a combination of screens. I think it's a combination of changing how we taught reading. And now that this big change of trying to go back to phonics, I think it is certainly COVID didn't help anyone. But it sounds like a lot of this started before COVID anyways.
5 years before COVID.
And what I know less about, because like I feel like I was a kid during No Child Left Behind, which was obviously the signature Bush education policy, right? And then, correct me if I'm wrong, but then Obama got in and they started rolling that back.
Yeah, they issued waivers and like everyone, like 40
so
states took them up
because
on
it. When I think of No Child Left Behind, this is showing my youth, I think of like mandatory testing and teachers starting to switch and like teach the test. And so some of the programs like civics and other extracurricular, softer educational programs lost funding because all these schools and their money was tied to tests.
Yeah, they required No Child Left Behind.
So there was criticism as far as, is this actually producing best and brightest? But now with rolling that back, we're obviously seeing a decline in reading and math across the country.
I would argue when you dumb down testing, both in the standards, grading levels, and I've talked about this before, not on our show, I don't think, but in previous iterations, where a child can come in and constantly retake the test till they pass, it sort of eliminates the need to study in the first place. You're giving them multiple. That's a real thing.
So is it because school is just easier now?
I think schools, school districts, administrations have tried to, sort of the discussion we're having with student violence, keep every kid in school, do whatever you can, make it easier for them. I think that's part of the problem.
But placate parents.
Yeah, placate parents. My kid's not stupid. Well, here's the thing, parents. Some of your kids are stupid. And sometimes it's because of you they're stupid.
Because you're stupid.
Yeah, I mean, basically that's it. What's the number that just got thrown out last week on all over the place? I saw it. Half the country's adults read at like sixth grade level. It's like, are you serious?
Well, and that's what I mean as far as this being a, and I don't know. Does it come back to underfunding? Does it come back to lack of standardization? I mean, do we really think that getting rid of the Department of Education is going to help this situation?
Probably not. That's just a political move. What I think, again, what I think, I'm not an educational expert, although I talk to a lot of people who are away from the show and sometimes on the show. I think this phone things is a good start. I know that the data can be used in a lot of different ways, but I want kids to focus. I've been an advocate for a long time of make a test a test. None of this retaking. If you get a bad grade, study harder next time. And the next test, you can bring your grade level, grade average up. Also, discipline matters. I don't want to spend a lot of time because we focused on that a little bit with Will Flanders. The other thing that kids have to feel safe and secure in their schools. Anybody think that's changed in the last, 25 years? Kinda. We're training kids for mass shooting. They're not public safety officers. They're kids. We have kids slaughtered in their schools. You don't think that has some role, small role to play? I think it does.
Well, there's also an issue. I mean, there's less absenteeism than there was in 2022. So that's rebounding a little bit more. But you think about if more and more families, especially lower income families, are struggling, it's not unheard of for kids to be skipping class to go work a job.
Sure.
To help pay bills at home.
Now, one of the things that gets talked about a lot is the Mississippi example. And they have made incredible
huge strides.
I mean, like, people are copying them.
Yeah.
I don't know. 20 years ago, no one was copying Mississippi and how they were teaching their kids. That's changed completely. Colleston Morgan mentions it from City Forward Collective. Other people that we've had on mentioned it. I think Will Flanders mentioned it yesterday. It is an example of what you can do when you focus on basics. And I've said this before. I'm a basics guy. I know that we love to have all the diversity of classes and options. And I'm not against that. If you've earned your way by getting the stuff you need to actually get a high school diploma, accomplished first. Look, I don't want to suppress arts. I'm not that person. I love the arts. I go to plays. I love music. I'm not that guy. But you got to get the other stuff right, because chances are you're not going to be hired as an arts whatever. You know, you're probably not going to work in that field. So you might want to focus on, reading and mathematics and science and some of the basic stuff. And I would throw civics in there as well, because we are painfully unaware. All you got to do is look at a social media platform to see how painfully most people are unaware of who their elected representatives are, what they do, what powers they do and don't have. I would include that in the core things. But until you're getting those right, and reading's getting all the focus. But I would argue math is, and I hated math, but I still took it.
Did you take calculus?
I didn't have to.
I got out of taking calculus,
I didn't have. My wife, Kathy, taught calculus at a high level to the AP kids, let's put it that way. For her, it's just inherent. She has a math degree, not a teaching degree. Well, she has a teaching degree too, but she got a math degree. That says something. People are wired differently, and I get that. I didn't have to take calculus, so I didn't take it. I knew I wasn't going to be a math. I wasn't going to be working that in
You're going to be a yapper. Journalism major.
A yapper. That's me. A yapper. You got to take a break. What do you think? Like, what do you blame it on? I guess is the question. Like, there's a lot of things. I think we highlighted some of those. But more importantly, how are we fixing this? Because it kind of matters. You got to. A young child. I have grandkids.
Send her to private school. Let's fix the public schools.
Fix the public schools. I love public schools. I went to them for half of my school life. I did both. So I feel like I have a good
base. I did both too.
I have a good base. It probably makes us smarter. All right. Quick break. Point taken. Education failing, especially over the last 10 years, it's not just pandemic related. So as much as that didn't help, don't just lay it at the feet of that. One of the things that a lot of people were commenting on our Mississippi comment, one of the reasons for their most recent success and why many states are now following their examples, early childhood education. That might be the kicker of all kickers. That's the one.
I mean, anyone who's had a kid, this is the thing that drives me nuts, because we talk about making childcare more affordable. And part of that is also making early childhood education affordable and starting them as young as we can. Because if anyone who knows a toddler and how much they are picking up every single day, we talk about them being sponges all the time, right? And so if you put them in an environment where they are actually having organized curriculum, like we get, this is a shout out to our school. Like we got so lucky getting into this school. We get a novel every Friday of what the kids did
that
week.
Cool?
And they have units. They have units on weather. They have units on colors. They have units on shapes. They had units on feelings. They had units on food. And like all of these like bigger topics where all of the sensory tables and the activities tie back to the unit. And I'm sorry, but there is no way in hell if I was a stay-at-home mom, Frankie would have the development that she has right now.
Yeah.
Because I'm not trained to teach her that stuff. Yeah. I don't know how, like, what the developmentally accurate way to teach a 2.5-year-old about, like, colors is and the repetitive nature and all the different things that they're doing that, like, my kid, I look at her, I'm like, how do you know this already? And so the fact that she is in this school getting this kind of attention with this kind of, like, accurate, informed curriculum is setting her up to be that much more prepared by the time she's in kindergarten. She's in first grade. And so if we can get more kids enrolled in programs like that, how much better are they all going to be by the time they hit elementary school?
Completely agree. Completely endorsed. On one of the early episodes of Squidiology, I had Shaka Smart, coach of Marquette, and his brilliant wife, Maya, on my podcast. She wrote a book called, I want to make sure I get the name of the book correct. It's out. It came out in 2022. I'll find it while I'm talking. And it basically emphasized the importance of, from birth, reading to kids.
Oh, yeah. That was the number one thing our pediatrician told us as far as, like, you know, like, she's an infant, but the more words they hear from the very get-go, the better.
It's called Reading for Our Lives, a Literacy Action Plan from Birth to Six. And I was just blown away by how smart she was and to write this book, and I read the book. It's an example of what parents can do. So we talked about the early childhood education. We're not all teachers. We don't necessarily know how to teach this stuff.
Or have the patience to.
But if you have a kid, or have the patience, yeah. That goes for grandparents too. Zero patience sometimes. No, you have the ability to read to your kid. Sometimes it just starts with you reading to them. And eventually they're touching the pages. They're seeing words they might see over and over again. They're hearing the story because you know anything about kids. They want to read the same damn story for a little
bit. We're on Beauty and the Beast right now.
Woo.
And we're also on the point because that's like a long version of Beauty and the Beast.
It ends well.
So it's a lot of us telling the story instead of actually reading the words on the page so we can get through it like a little bit faster at that time.
Yeah, so don't tell me you can't do anything. Who doesn't
know the story like the back of her hand?
All right, Beauty and the Beast. Start with that. Start with anything. But yeah, I wanted to mention Maya Smart, great book. After the break, every time we do Salute to Service, and we have our Heroes Week next week where we just finished our interviews, we'll be releasing those names and meeting those people next week. We always highlight the ones from last year in the week before. We'll have another one of our honorees from 2025 after this. Every week in the week before Heroes Week for WTMJ and Waterstones Bank Salute to Service, we play our honorees from last year. Here's one from the City of Waukesha, Waukesha Police Officer Dan Reese.
I'm Leslie Frederick. I nominated Dan Reese for Salute to Service.
Hi, I'm Dan Reese. I work for the City of Waukesha Police Department.
He got an award for Rookie of the Year for police officer.
I've been with the Waukesha Police Department 12 years at the end of this month.
I've known Dan for many, many years. Seen him growing up. Heard him wanting to be a cop and everything. Once he got to be a cop, he always wanted to handle canines, and then when he had the opportunity to handle canines, he went for it and got approved for it.
Lambo is the dog.
Yes.
In question.
He's gorgeous.
I got paired up with Lambo 1 year ago. Right now, he's still under a year into his career, so I'd equate that to like a new officer out on the road. We graduated from handler school together. He was about 5 weeks into his career. When he's out of the car, he's looking up at me. And it's pretty incredible knowing he's always got my back. He's with me all the time, whether he likes it or not.
He's done a lot of work. Like, he's really good at his job. He doesn't like people, from what I understand. But
he likes his officer.
He loves his officer.
Lots of people have pets. The day-to-day maintenance isn't anything I'm not used to. It's more so the extra liability that this dog is trained to apprehend people and teaching him the difference between work and home. That's been one of the bigger stressors in our life. Got deployed to a barricaded subject in Waukesha. Subject was wielding a machete and holding his roommate hostage. He ended up barricading himself in a garage. And after the tactical unit tried anything and everything to get him to peacefully comply, they utilized tear gas, flashbangs, things of those natures. We were able to see on a drone footage that he put the machete down, and we decided to deploy Lambo into the garage, and he actually apprehended the guy.
Who's calmer in these situations, you or Lambo?
I'd like to think me, but I'm going to say Lambo. This week has not been a good week for us. We're prepping for certification. He has to recertify annually. It's a series of tests for tracking and bite work and drug detection and all that. During the bite work preparation, he broke a canine tooth almost off at his gum line. So he actually had surgery this morning to clean that up and repair that a little bit.
So full report, Lambo is going to be just fine?
Just fine.
What does Salute to Service mean to you?
To me, it really means honoring those who have come before us, really. Those that have made law enforcement or first responding the reputation that it is. Just trying to do my best to live up to that reputation. Being out there, making a positive difference in the community, going home safe at the end of the night. It's something different every day, knowing that you can actually make a difference in someone's life when they need it most.
O'clock on a Thursday means it's time for a full hour of city stories with Urban Milwaukee President Jeremy Janine on Point Taken.
Everybody wants to be closer to free.
All right, Jeremy, how are you today?
I am absolutely lovely.
We just learned that you're not a nickname guy. You've never had nicknames in your life?
I had one friend call me Double J at some point, but yeah.
That's a good one.
I've avoided nicknames.
Yeah, but your name's set up for it perfectly.
I know. Or J squared.
Triple J? I mean, got a J in it as a middle name, too? Yeah,
I'm a junior J in that sense.
Okay.
An R middle name.
Oh, JRJ.
There you go.
Anyway.
All right, let's get... Well, third week in a row we're talking about leaves?
Third week in a row we're talking leaves. Hard to believe, but the story keeps moving, so we'll start it where it started 2 or 3 weeks ago. Public Works Commissioner Gerald Krushke, in a larger discussion about flooding, and then there was a discussion about potholes, all the things that were happening in April because of the weird weather we were experiencing, says that the city was going to change its leaf pickup policy. Instead of raking them into the street, they're going to mandate that you bag them or mulch them in your yard, as we've talked about at length. So that was the change. Then, and that was a surprise apparently to the council, which resulted in a second week of discussion when several council members indicated they might bag the policy themselves, pun intended, because they didn't feel like they were notified in advance.
And tantrum. Go ahead.
They felt their constituents were upset about it, and there was a big concern. Oh, they need to be able to rake them into the street instead of put them in bags. Well, the mayor, Cavalier Johnson, and Commissioner Krushke clearly heard those concerns, because now we have a third week of stories where the city is going with the all-of-the-above policy for getting rid of the leaves, which is you'll be able to bag them. In fact, that's what the city would like you to do. Actually, first, endorsing Steve, Commissioner Krushke says, mulch them in your yard first. Right. Best option.
That's always, everyone tells you it's the best option.
Improve soil quality, can help your garden, all those things.
Grass looks better.
Second thing they'd like you to do, if you can't do that, bag them. And then if you must, you can rake them into the street.
So here's my question that I hadn't thought about before. So the big problem last year was leaves were in the street. It was a late fall, early winter with the first snowfall. So leaves didn't get picked up. Why do we think that the bags would get picked up?
Because you can see the... So what happens, you rake them into the street. I'm just speaking from experience on Lenox Street for myself. People drive on top of the leaf piles. They get shoved down. They freeze, even if they're not snow covered. So when it gets cold enough at the ground level...
So they have moisture in them.
Yeah.
So it's basically like, even if it snows, it's like easier to pick up a bag after it snows.
Yes. I mean, most importantly, you can see it under any scenario and lift it up.
All right.
They're contained, I think is the... So, given this three-legged stool scenario, what's preventing anyone from just the lazy people, the people who don't want to change because we've always done it that way, from just doing the third thing and nothing changes?
The third thing being raking it into the street doing nothing?
Yeah, well, I guess there's four things, but the raking it in the street.
They can continue to do that. That was the agreement now.
Yeah, so...
Now it just becomes like a PSA of, like, please bag them.
Yes. So my question was immediately, well, what's it going to cost to do both options?
Yeah, really.
And there is no fiscal estimate. There was a suggestion when the policy was initially announced a couple of weeks ago that it was going to cost slightly more to pick them up in bags, but that might be offset by some savings you would get from not having as many clogged drains other benefits.
And I know you guys have probably talked about this, but the bags themselves... are biodegradable?
The bags are biodegradable. Okay. They cost about $2 a piece. The city's already rolled out one program to give bags away.
Free bags. One of the things was, how can some people afford it? Why would they pay for something that they can just, now they can just sweep in the street?
Can I put other yard waste in the bag?
If it's natural, yeah.
Compostable, so
like
what, yeah.
Like old mulch and...
That's a question for the city. I'm not sure. But if it's like plant matter, I would assume that'd be
so okay. I'm trying to think organic. About the, like my wife takes her garden and cleans out stuff and yeah. ends up in the pile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If it's like plants, yes. If it's yes. big branches,
yeah,
no.
Because that's okay. a whole different process. They have a branch pickup too, right?
Yeah, there's a clean and green right yeah. now, and then there's a fall pickup as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, I think ours is like May 27th, so I'm trying to get things in order to pick up all that yard
I'm generally a fan of Mayor Johnson. Those are tough jobs. He is a guy that gets it, but I think sort of this sort of indecisive, let's make everyone happy is not leadership. It's poor leadership, and I would say at some point.
You don't
point,
think it's responsive?
No.
As far as listening no, to what people's reaction was?
Because most people would probably do the normal things and just follow the new rules. But there's always an edgy, loud, non-compliant group that just doesn't want to change because they love the way they've always done it. And as somebody who actually has governmental experience, it's always a small group, but they're very loud. And that's exactly, my opinion, what happened here.
I think that's a fair criticism. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you wanted to look at something else to criticize, clearly announcing the change in the middle of an hours-long discussion
timing.
About flooding
mood is
was
wrong.
A mistake.
Mood is wrong. Yes, exactly.
And if you had messaged the council beforehand, we're going to get behind this. Here's how we're going to give away free bags. That could have...
Oh, that seems like a theme today.
Dramatically, yes. Hinting at a future topic we'll discuss in a couple segments.
Jeremy Janine. President, janitor, chief janitor, gift shop organizer, order.
JJ the janitor.
Sometimes clerk.
There we go, the triple J.
Triple J. There it is. You found it for us.
Got it.
We'll keep on all of these stories about Milwaukee and Milwaukee County after this On Point Taken on 620 WTMJ.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen. He's Steve. It's Thursday, so Jeremy Janine is here to talk all things Milwaukee. And we talked about this a little bit yesterday with Will Flanders from Will, Wisconsin Institute for
Law and Liberty.
Thank you, brain fart. Because they have taken up the case for the food trucks. But there sounds like there is different proposals beyond just telling food trucks they can't be open past 10 p.m. to try to calm street takeovers and young people taking over Water Street and Brady Street and what to do with the after hours twerking in the streets, because I have seen those videos.
Yeah, so what we're talking about here is primarily on Water Street, but also on what's now MLK Drive, but historically the Old World 3rd Street Business District, two parallel bar districts downtown. And again, primarily on Water Street, primarily on weekend nights, really late. There is a huge problem with loitering that becomes violent. And they're not people going in and out of the bars. They're people that go down there to party and never go inside the bar. Based on police department data and their testimony to the Common Council, many of the people they're arresting are not 21. So you would really hope they're not going into the bars then. And so you have this problem that is associated with these bars, but it's not actually directly caused by the bars, which has created this really weird outcome of trying to regulate it and the city wrap its hands around. And it's been going in spurts since 2021. It was really when it first flared up. And it obviously, similar to street takeovers that you hit on, happens when it gets warmer. So this Common Council tried to get ahead of this year. They did kind of three things. They tightened down the food truck regulations. So they're already restricted at 1 a.m. downtown and on Burnham Street on the far southwest side. They moved that to 10 p.m. and that we'll talk about that in a minute. They considered fencing off the area, which is what happens at Beale Street in Memphis, which is a similar bar district. Like, could you wand... Yeah. For weapons and just like, yeah, you can come hang out here, but you can't bring anything in with you. And then the third thing was, and the city could do this administratively, no council action necessary, but they restricted scooters. So with scooters, the concern was surges of crowds, people being able to very quickly in large groups come and go. And that has stretched down even to the 3rd Street Market Hall here.
There's data suggests that people are doing that to get there?
The police department anecdotally suggests it's happening.
All right. Well, you can see the scooters or not. I mean...
And so what they did with scooters was, I think, a very sensible regulatory thing where you can ride. Because I'm like, what about the bartender who gets off work? Or what about the person working at the food hall here to get home? You can ride through certain streets that are more suitable for, like, 6th Street, streets that are friendlier to scooters. And then certain other areas are restricted. You can't park. There's slow zones. So you can still get through the area on a scooter, but you can't in mass get there on a scooter. That's happening. Then the proposal to fence off the area, well, that's not happening now because Alderman Robert Baumann, as a result of the food truck thing, is sick of everyone pointing at him as the problem here. He's like, I want to hear from Visit Milwaukee. I want to hear from Westtown. I want to hear from Milwaukee downtown. So yesterday he pulled the plug on studying fencing off the area, said, I want to hear from these groups. So I immediately reached out to those groups. No response from Visit. Westtown says they're reviewing it as a board, and Milwaukee downtown said the same thing. Bauman says that those groups have informally endorsed the idea before, and the Milwaukee Police Department.
Is he right about that?
The police department at least publicly has. It, based on his prior comments, they've endorsed it. I don't know if they've explicitly come out and said, we want this.
Well, because they represent the bars and the restaurants and stuff as far as what are the pros and cons for any of those bars, as far as is it going to hurt their traffic and their people wanting to go there if they have to go get wanded to, like, go into Elwood's or go into the brewery.
Or on the other side, would they feel safer?
Exactly. Yes. And, like, that's, I think you have to hear from the owners of those establishments to feel like they have a say in how this is going to impact their business.
And that issue feels like it's coming to a head in a couple weeks. It's either going to die or we're going to get some type of statement. And then finally, we have the food truck thing, which is an interesting lawsuit from Will, because the city has long exercised regulations on food trucks and other things in the public right of way. They're not on private property like a bar, so you can largely regulate them. But Will is now arguing that's not the case.
Economic freedom is the argument that was made.
Yes, and the city's response will largely be they're on our property, the public right of way, and we have the rights to regulate them. So we'll see where that goes in court.
Going back to the fence proposal that these groups, these organizations are reviewing, are those manned by police department
personnel, or private? So that was the request, and the fence proposal was go study this, come up with a plan within 60 days that we can look to implement. One of the things Bauman said right away was, I don't think the police department has the staffing to man this.
Yeah.
Who would Milwaukee downtown go hire its ambassadors? Who would actually
Was what was interesting. I would actually love to look into this. So we were in Nashville a couple of weeks ago, and there's during the day up and down Broadway, there's people directing traffic. And I don't even mean like car traffic. I mean like foot traffic, as far as when cars are trying to turn and making sure people are stopping. And granted, there's a lot of foot traffic on Broadway in Nashville, but they were wearing, everyone who had that job was wearing like a yellow vest. And it was unclear to me because it didn't look like they had a badge. So it seemed like a different staffing than police officers, who their job was to kind of crowd control on a very busy street. So I don't know if that's an opportunity that you're not putting dedicated police officers down there, but it's a, I don't know, a new kind of role. And I don't know whose budget it comes from.
Yeah, that's one of the questions that the city wants sorted out. Another thing we should mention, because commenters in Urban Milwaukee pointed to, like, what about regulating cars? Well, actually, cars on weekend nights are already restricted from Water Street. The street is closed.
Yeah.
And the city has, in years past, made pretty widespread no parking restrictions, again, to try and eliminate large groups forming and encourage people to get there by bus, by Uber, Lyft, those type of things.
I think the police involvement is interesting because you can make the argument, if they're going to be there anyway, dealing with the repercussions of not having secure an area for people to go to the food trucks, go to the bars, the ones that want to, or even for the people that have, at some point, a right to hang out in Milwaukee if they're allowed to, at the right age, all that stuff. I think there's a point to be made for being proactive on the police side, saying, you know, let's calm it before it explodes into a bigger situation which is going to require even more police personnel, assets, time. So, I mean, you can make that argument.
I think that's a fair argument. Like, that was one of the things Bauman raised, is this could actually be a net positive for the police. And that's become a political issue at City Hall, is Code Red, which is this overtime-based enforcement for the bar districts.
Right.
Other council members that don't represent the downtown area want to see more enforcement in their district, and they're pointing to downtown. Hey, there's all these police officers here. I'd like them to come out to my district.
Everybody wants something. All right. He is Jeremy Jean. That was profound, wasn't it? Jeremy Jean, president. And what other chief titles do you have there?
Co-founder, janitor, accountant, bookkeeper.
And you're a brilliant writer, all things Milwaukee City.
Shopkeeper.
For the folks who ask, where's the shop?
The Tchotchke Shop, UrbanMilwaukeeTheStore.com, or 755 North Milwaukee Street, corner of Milwaukee and Mason, right by Hotel Metro and the Pfister Hotel.
And if you break it, you buy it, right?
If you break it, you buy it.
That's right, because that's going to weigh into our decisions to record a video there, because I'm breaking something. I can tell you that right now. Quick break. Jeremy Jean from UrbanMilwaukee.com. Great resource for all things Milwaukee, Milwaukee County, City of Milwaukee. How about this one? When I see these two hits in this segment, divided and fighting. So let's get to the divided first.
Good radio. So the Common Council has for a couple weeks now been struggling with what to do with this very small slice of this very large grant. 2021, the City of Milwaukee, like governments, state government, county government, all across the country, were getting, the city in particular was given $394 million from the American Rescue Plan Act, a federal fund. And the idea was all these great generational investments were going to come. Well, what we now know, and it was also to bridge the gap for governments recovering for COVID. That was the impetus for this policy. Well, the city of Milwaukee really bridged that gap by plugging about two-thirds of that money in to fill budget holes. So $394 million shrank rather drastically. We're now getting to the end of where that funding can be spent at the end of 2026. Like, one of the really good things the city did was Homes MKE, take vacant city-owned tax foreclosed homes, fixing them up, getting them in affordably sold to owner-occupants. Great policy. But there's now some leftover money because you have to spend it by the end of 2026 or give it back to the federal government. They'll come asking for that money and they'll take it. So $600,000, you can only spend it on programs you've previously allocated money to. So you don't have many options, but the city or the council sure fought about it enough. Mayor Cavalier Johnson put forward a proposal. It was basically completely ignored. Marina Dmitrievich put forward a proposal. She wanted to give it to this unconditional cash grant program for low-income mothers, known as the Bridge Project, and then Legal Aid Society Eviction-Free MKE program, which is a right-to-counsel program for people facing evictions. Her proposal got twice voted down at committee by Peter Bergelis and Charlotte Moore, who had introduced a different proposal that spread what Scott Spiker and Dmitrievich said was the pot way too thin to several more initiatives. And it seemed like Dmitrievich was going to lose, but she took the issue to the council floor. And in this who's on first, I don't know, is on second type moment on Tuesday, the council ended up actually adopting her proposal and a bit of good politicking on her part because she had persuaded just enough members to vote for her policy. So the Bridge Project, which seemed to have the least amount of support at committee, ended up getting the full council support. And you're going to get money going towards unconditional cash grants, low-income mothers. Zilber Family Foundation is putting in $3.3 million.
Outstanding organization.
I've interviewed on this program before. It's very effective.
Yeah, it is very effective. The argument was not that it wasn't effective, but that the Earn and Learn program and teens were the bigger focus.
And Marina is a great orator, so it doesn't surprise me that she was able to convince a few people, because I've known her for 15 years. She's persuasive.
And one last thing Marina is up to, Alderwoman Dmitrievich.
A lot of focus on her today.
I guess in this story block, We Energies is proposing rate increases for 2027 and 2028. It would add about $23 a month by the end of 2028 to the average residential bill. She, as she has consistently done, is leading the city to attempt to intervene in that case. What that means is that the city will formally file at the state level to say, hey, we don't want We Energies to increase their rates this much. Whether that goes anywhere remains to be seen.
All right. My quick take, I'm a fan of We Energies, but read the room on rates. Just saying. All right. We always enjoy our time spent every Thursday, 11 o'clock hour. We tweak it every once in a while. Sometimes we have early outs and stuff for Brewers, which, by the way, Brewers this afternoon. So us in all of our splendor, point taken, a news update, and then Brewers. So great afternoon, great morning. Jeremy and Janine in studio, as he often is. TIF, tax incremental financing. I spent a lot of my public life working in these areas. I think a great story here.
Sometimes people take a big risk and it seems scary at first and then it pays off. And then in this case, it continues to pay off for all kinds of unintended ways.
Yeah.
1996, Pabst Brewing Company, like there were still beer cans left on the desk and pencils and stuff because they just closed middle of the shift. 10 years later, there was this, or even 8 years later, there was this plan for this Pabst City thing. There's this big entertainment complex that I think in hindsight we can all agree, like developing a Sega Entertainment Center at where the Pabst Brewery used to be on the northwest side of downtown, wouldn't have worked. So in comes, and you praised the Zilber Family Foundation before, 2006, in comes Joseph Zilber. I think he was in his 80s at the point. He said, I want this to be my legacy, but I need the city to step up as a partner. The city creates a tax incremental financing district. I think a massive 20-some acre empty campus qualifies as blight by anyone's definition. So they contribute something in the order of $25 million in future tax revenue to fix up streets. I think they helped build the parking garage. They helped build a park that I actually got married in, Zilber Park.
Oh, nice connection.
So all these kind of things to fix up that area. There's now $240 million of incremental assessed value there.
Yeah.
That's generated $33 million of new tax revenue, which recovered that 20-some million, also paved a bunch of streets downtown. Now that district has to, under state law, close by the 2033 or something. The city now has a plan, $22 million, to invest in public infrastructure west of I-43. This property butts up to I-43. State law says in a TIF district, you can spend the money on public infrastructure within a half mile. Well, that stretches to part of Marquette's campus and the whole way out to 16th Street west of downtown. King Park, an area that in the 1960s, there was a completely botched urban renewal scheme. You can still see the scars of it in terms of empty lots over there. Basically, every street on the west side of I-43 that's within that half-mile circle, and you can see this on Urban Milwaukee, is going to get repaved. There's $2 million coming to King Park to improve the park, which has regrettably become a housing, I guess, for the unhoused, because it's just kind of a odd protected overlook space. And then there's a cluster of vacant lots, 38 of them, between Juneau and Highland, basically 16th and 14th. The city is going to take its growing MKE initiative and build owner-occupied housing there. And all of this is being funded by the tax revenue from the brewery district development. So that money, if you're like, how does downtown development help me? Here it's coming over I-43, which Lafayette Crump called an imaginary barrier we've constructed. It's coming over there and helping what is truly an impoverished neighborhood and can make it hopefully turn things around.
Go ahead. Who's spearheading this redevelopment? Is there a new Zilber that is behind this, or is this just a purely a city initiative?
So this is the city laid the groundwork to harvest the tax revenue in 2006. They did that to improve the brewery district. They're now taking the excess and spending that in the way they want on the west side.
It's a classic example of how TIFs can really, really perform. And it's a hard argument because I've had the argument. People going, why would we invest $23 million or $30 million or got some of these things going up past 100? Because there's sometimes a reason why that initial investment on infrastructure can do amazing things even beyond the scope of the TIF. And this one, the cool part is now it's the next chapter of that story. It's not perfect. There are some that don't do that well, but in the right place, right time, administered by both communities that understand the process and developers and other partners, man, you can have some great success. So this seems like a win.
It clearly is. Last week I wrote about there's a third ward TIF at the south end of the third ward used to develop some of the most expensive. Well, it was used to fund the Riverwalk next to some of the most expensive buildings in the city. It generated more than $70 million in incremental revenue. The two TIFs the city has that are on the verge of not working out, two affordable housing developments, the city's able to donate from one TIF to the other one, putting those TIFs, McKinley School and Garfield Street School, which is America's Black Holocaust Museum, on firmer footing, allows those developments 5 years from now to probably fund public infrastructure around them.
Good stuff. And I'm glad you brought that story because a lot of people aren't aware of the implications of when you hear TIF and then you think, another big expenditure. It actually has a long-term play that works out for most people. Kristen Steed, Point Taken, Jeremy Janine, our guest for the full hour, as always on Thursday. We'll get to data center, ? Maybe we'll do some other stuff as well after this.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen. He is Steve, talking to Jeremy Janine. And the topic I had, or the first question I had for Jeremy, and I should have known it was on our list of things to talk about. But last night, my husband asked, he goes, they're going to do a data center at Midtown? And I go, well, one, I haven't heard about that yet. But two, like, data centers are not all created equally. Like, a data center as a entity is something that holds servers, right? And a hyperscaler that's in Port Washington is literally multiple football fields of space, which is not, no matter how big you think Midtown is, not that. So what is happening right now as far as a proposed data center in this city of Milwaukee?
I think this is a case of you break it, you buy it, and I'm having to buy my words back.
Okay.
I published a paywalled article that said self-storage data center plan for former Walmart, which is objectively what's happening. The deck of the story says new uses would accompany planned library. They'd also accompany affordable housing. If you stop there and didn't read the article, you could construct any sort of concept in your head of what's happening. If you read the article, you would learn that this is a 150,000 square foot vacant former Walmart. We talked, I think Todd Elbow was here on the day, that the parking lots are going to become 200 units of affordable housing. And then a week ago, I think we talked about that a new library, a replacement for the Capitol Drive Library, is going to go into the front of the former Walmart. And this is all proposed, but the affordable housing has been approved. Next week, these other uses will be up for debate. This Walmart's been vacant since 2016. So you have a new library going in the front. I'm going to give you a number. Keep it in your head. 17,000 square feet for a library, standard size for most city libraries. You're also going to get about a 35,000 square foot community use. The city has yet to reveal it, but I'm confident in discussions with sources, it's going to be something everyone agree with is a community use. Now you have 150,000 square feet. You've just taken out 50,000 square feet there. So you have the back of the Walmart now. This company, Affordable Family Storage, since 2023, and the city has denied them previously, has wanted to develop a self-storage facility. They've come to a kumbaya moment with this library in front. They're going to put a fairly large self-storage facility in the back. But in the corner furthest away from 60th Street that you can get, basically hidden in the back of where all these midtown buildings come together, they're going to put in a 19,000 square foot, what they call, and I get the exact words they use because they twisted themselves into knots not to call it a data center. They're going to put in a data processing / computer services / computer research facility, which if you're like, well, what is that? Data center is clearly what that is. But at 19,000 square feet, it is nowhere near the first building Microsoft just booted up, which is 1.2 million square feet. These things are not the same.
These are not the same.
I saw people tweeting out yesterday, it wasn't Do the Right Thing, Milwaukee, or You Know What to Do, Milwaukee, about this topic. What are they trying to tell me?
So there's this graphic now going around that has this, that there's this data center proposed here, and they circle the entire 15-acre property. Well, it's this small little back corner that they're going to put this data center. And those things, I'm pointing back to the back of the studio here because you guys have a computer server room. Like the MSOE campus has a data center downtown. Potawatomi has a data center near like 33rd and Wells. All these very small facilities that pre-AI weren't a big deal. All of a sudden, data center is this loaded term. That's not what's happening in these gigantic things, small thing in the back of the building.
All right, we're going to take a break early because we got a hard out for the Brewers coming up after our next segment. Jeremy Janine joining us. After the break, I'm going to tell you a story next week about a firefighter delivering a baby on duty. Our next conversation is about a gentleman who just passed away who delivered, birthed a lot of babies. And he deserves the recognition. We're going to give him some love after this. I love great stories. This is a great story. I'm going to let Jeremy tell it. Jeremy Janine, UrbanMilwaukee.com, Dr. William Finlayson.
On Monday, Milwaukee lost a giant in more ways than one. William Finlayson, Dr. William Finlayson, practiced as an OBGYN in Milwaukee for more than 40 years. That in itself is impressive. He was the first black OBGYN at St. Joseph's Hospital and at what is now Aurora Sinai, just outside of downtown. And in that 40-year window, he delivered 10,000 children.
Just think of the families he impacted. I love that story.
And at 40 years, he probably delivered mom and daughter and like
baby granddaughter, three generations.
And he started. He arrived in Milwaukee in 1958.
Yes, and he went to Morehouse College, which history buffs might go, oh, did he know that guy? Yes, he was a classmate of Martin Luther King Jr. at Morehouse College. He actually brought Martin Luther King Jr. to Milwaukee to do part of the open housing marches with Val Phillips in the 1960s. Father James Garoppi. Now the three of them, that is Phillips, King, and Finlayson, are all honored on parallel streets. That was a very deliberate decision in 2022. So you have 3rd Street became Dr. Martin Luther King Drive. 4th Street, north of downtown, became Velar Phillips Drive. And then 5th Street, north of downtown, became Dr. William Finlayson Street. And that was in 2022. It was very deliberate by Mullaly Coggs, who represents the area, to honor someone while they were still living. I was honored then to learn a lot about him at that time. He unfortunately passed away at the age of, very impressive, 101.
Wow.
Yeah,
on
that was impressive.
And tributes poured in from all corners of Milwaukee. You had the county executive, you had the mayor, but mostly you had the common council weighing in strong fashion. Alderman Russell Stamper was a member of Phi Alpha, which is a black fraternity with him, and he knew Finlayson very well, and he said it in a way that I'm paraphrasing here, but if you weren't, as a black person in Milwaukee, delivered by William Finlayson, someone else you knew very clearly was, 10,000 people is just tremendous work. And to be a civil rights pioneer in terms of the first black OBGYN at two key institutions.
Cliche, but a life well lived, and just the public service that this man did. I mean, wow, that's almost as good as it gets. All right, a quick hitter before we let you get out of here.
Yes, there was something that happened yesterday, and that is the FBI showed up at Michelle Hawley's house. If you're like 99% of people in Milwaukee, you're like, who is that? Michelle Hawley now is the top election official in the county clerk's office. So she doesn't directly oversee each of the municipal elections. Those are like Paulina Gutierrez in Milwaukee, but she is the top county official. There is an FBI investigation, as the Journal Sentinel actually was the first to report, into the 2020 election, still, again, something that through all these different experts has no basis, but the FBI didn't come to her office. They came to her house. I find it extra weird because Michelle Hawley was not the CHOP election official in 2020. She was the deputy at that point.
That is a fundamental problem with what I have. What are you doing here? This indicates you don't even know what you're doing when you're trying to go after some alleged stealing of an election, which, first of all, is BS, but two, it's already been adjudicated in many, many cases across the country, and we're going after people who weren't even involved in that conversation.
And then they show up at her house and like the office.
At her house. Yeah. What are we doing here?
And she apparently wasn't home or didn't answer the door. They left a card. County Clerk George Christensen, an elected official who would technically be her boss, put out a pretty impressive statement in defense of her and questioning the practice of, why did you go to her house? Why didn't you come to our office? And so that raises concern about this 2020 thing is just not going away.
It's not
going
to go away.
And here we go as we're starting to talk about midterms in 2026 and who's going to run in 2028.
Well, of all the stories that just have had inability to just go away, this one is fascinating because I criticized when they started talking about shenanigans and all that nonsense right after it. And one famous state rep said we should have an election do-over, like that was going to happen. Like that, just the stupidity attached to this. And if you're one of these people who thinks this is a good thing, you might want to reexamine your life values. This is just stupidity. It's more stupidity. It's actually wasting assets and resources of our government, which last time I checked was something that most people were against.
Yeah, 15 seconds.
All right. We will be back tomorrow. Bill and Joe, Jeremy Janine, UrbanMilwaukee.com, a great resource for all things local. Kristen, you're amazing as always.
You too, man.
A lot of self-praise and love. Go Brewers! Get it done! Still hurting for that game last night. News next.